Good evening or good morning when you're watching this. Welcome back to Hoops HD 2017-2018 wrap-up special. It's over.
There's no games. Not one.
We have a national champion. Congratulations to the Villanova Wildcats. And we are 217 days away from our next official college basketball game. Want to wrap up the tournament, go over a few other things, wrap up the whole season here tonight, so a bunch of stuff to get to. But let's start with the Final Four, the national championship game. And, John Tytel, let me start with you. I know you've got some Philly ties. And how about what ended up being a pretty darn dominant performance by Villanova in this tournament?
Agreed. When you win every single game by double digits and make 10 threes a game, and yeah, it was pretty amazing. Not just the past month, but the past three-year run. This is really not an all-time dynasty or anything, but they have proven that they are the equal of anybody in college basketball in the 2010s this decade. Coach Jay Wright looks like he's a near lock for Hall of Fame status in the years ahead. Jalen Brunson joining some elite company with a Player of the Year award and two rings. Dante DiVincenzo having the game of his life and the night of his life at the time it mattered the most. It was not my favorite Wildcat win ever, but it was in the top five, I guess.
Yeah, well, you said not a dynasty, but Joby, this is now two championships in 3 years for Villanova. And, you know, if they'd had Omari Smellman last year, who knows what could have happened.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been interesting, without a doubt. The fact is, the second time proves that the first time wasn't the fluke of Jay Wright getting out of the group of round of 32, because you know Villanova for years had that, hey, we're highly seeded, deservedly so, but man, they fall flat and no one trusts them on their brackets. This year proved that 2 years ago was not a fluke, so to speak, and Spellman was a key component to that, without a doubt. You saw it last night. He was able to take a very long, tall Michigan team and be the dominant player. I mean, the offensive rebound totals, which he didn't do all of them. I mean, Pascal had in the first half had that amazing, shot put rebound off the glass and iron. But he was a key component on getting the just double digit 10 offensive rebounds, and that was how Villanova pulled away, along with an outstanding change in their half-court defense that realized, whoa, this Wagner guy is pretty good. And they got Wagner gassed and in foul trouble where the offensive rebounds started flowing, and then they started hitting – DiVincenzo started hitting the threes. That's all she wrote. It was done by halftime. That four-point lead at the four-minute mark then expanded to nine. That really was where the game changed and was won by Villanova.
Yeah, it's not surprising that Nova won. Well, first, a couple stats. I know Stalika is our trivia guy. For the last 5 years, Nova has been seeded two or better. And in every year where they've made it past the round of 32, they've won the national title. So just kind of a fun stat there. But again, it isn't surprising that they won, but I was legitimately surprised at how well they played in the Final Four. I mean, I was impressed with them throughout the whole tournament, throughout the Big East, and really throughout the whole season. But the Final Four, where they were clearly – I mean, that Kansas team was really good, and they blitzed them and did the same to a Michigan team that plays pretty damn good defense, a real good defense, actually. I mean, the way they just lit them up, I thought maybe of all the – I mean – I think you have to almost go back to 2009 or 2012. Kentucky was pretty good, but even more so 2009 when North Carolina just rolled over the whole tournament field to see a single performance by a team in the Final Four that was as impressive as that. I mean, they won by 17 points, and that was the closer of the two games.
Well, and yeah, Dave, we talked about all season, for example, the Big 12 as one of the best conferences in the nation. It actually had 9 teams out of 10 in play for an NCAA tournament bid. The three best teams in that conference, West Virginia, Texas Tech, Kansas, they beat them back-to-back-to-back by double digits just to make that championship game. They did not have the easy path that Michigan had with having to play, not even playing a team, a top four seed to get there.
Right, and the last time they won the national championship, they had a really hard run because I think five of the six teams they had beaten had been ranked in the top 10 at one point. Like Iowa that year, who they played in the round of 32. I mean, I know they fell all the way down to the 7 line, but we were projecting them as a 1 seed during parts of that season. So Nova doesn't do it the easy way. They either lose in the round of 32 or they win at all.
All right. And Stalica, I mean, the other game we saw in the Final Four, the other semifinal, was probably the best of the three games this weekend, the Michigan-Loyola game. Loyola had a real shot there at most of the game to make it to that championship. But I think in that game, it was like they ran out of gas as opposed to the championship game where Michigan ran out of gas.
It was shaping up to be another typical Loyola game at halftime with guys like Custer and Towns having some pretty decent games. But with Michigan's shot starting to warm up in the second half, it just appeared like midnight was coming up for Loyola. And as our colleague Mike had noted, Loyola may have given up losing for Lent, which was technically over Saturday night.
There you go. But let's what about next year for this team? Titel, Villanova, do they have maybe it all comes down to who comes back and who doesn't come back, but could we see 3 out of 4 for the Wildcats, or could at least be in contention for it?
It absolutely comes back to who is in and who is out. If you look at the roster, one of the things that impressed me the most about this team is they did it not just with a little help from seniors, but with zero help from seniors. The junior class has to go down. Again, I don't think they're a dynasty yet. It's hard to get one in college basketball when you're only at a school for 4 years, whatever, if that. But Phil Booth, Eric Paschal, Jalen Brunson, Michael Bridges, like, that junior class is amazing, which is why they have 2 rings to their credit. If Brunson and Bridges leave, which I think is what a lot of the experts are saying, still gives them a solid starting 5. Can we finally get Dante into the starting lineup so the big Ragu can get a little more action on the court? I don't think Spellman will leave, but he could certainly think about it. I think if you lose 2 guys like Brunson and Bridges, it's just too much to overcome, though.
But I think it's also worth noting that as far as Brunson goes, he is scheduled to graduate a year early, so I suppose if he were going to be coming back for his senior year, he would be a grad student as well.
But Titel, I know you do take a look at NBA draft and who you think is going to go and where. Do you think they're both lottery picks?
Absolutely not. I think Bridges is, and he's trending upward. I don't think he's going to catch the top guys. It seems like the key to be a top 5 pick this year is you got to be 6'10", a freshman, and have been terrible in the tournament, like Ayton. Bagley is the exception. He went a little farther. Jaren Jackson flamed out early. Guys like that. I think that Bridges will sneak into the lottery and maybe the top 10. Brunson, I think, is late first round. He could be the shortest guy picked in the first round. I think he's only 6'2". There's a couple other 6'2 guys, but the NBA, they want size in the 21st century. So I don't think Brunson is going to crack the top 14.
Well, Joby, you're our ACC guy. I don't know how much you've already started to look at next season, but I'm again already hearing Duke could be the best team in the nation.
Yeah,
because they've got the top three recruits coming in.
Right, it's the same old. Now they don't have that real stable senior force that Grayson Allen provided. as I kid a little bit, Duke's going to be back. They're going to be back. They plug and play. But you know what? We're finding out, and I don't know if this year is the exception or the rule, but I'm going to start to be the rule that you better be able to gel. Going to that zone defense because of Bagley's weakness, defensively. Hello, NBA scouts. Start paying attention to that. Because of that, K actually had a damn good coaching year. He did a great job putting this team together. I worry long-term that, hey, not all these one-and-done guys are really true one-and-done talent level necessarily once you get them on the court. If some of them don't become Carter and Bagley and Trent and all that, then all of a sudden Duvall, then all of a sudden they have a missing piece and their bench is always going to be harmed by this because kids see their spots gone and they transfer out or et cetera. So Duke's going to be Duke again. They're going to be a top. They're going to be a protected seed. Could be a number one seed, but I really want to see more gelling of a team before I anoint them.
David, you had a thought on that too?
I did, but I forgot what it was.
Okay, never mind then. I'll tell you what. I want to talk about just very briefly a few other things outside of the Final Four that happened just in the past week.
Wait a minute. I did. Well, the something I wanted to bring up, and it's something that is grossly overlooked, grossly ignored, a huge cancer of a problem. Nova beats Michigan by 17. Well, earlier this year, there was a team that beat Michigan by more than 17, which you could argue means that they're better than Villanova. When Nebraska and Tim... What? I'm trying to finish my thought here.
You're done. I know you're talking Nebraska. I know you're talking Tim Miles. Actually, I want to discuss that a bit here, but a couple of things I want to hit on. There was three other teams that won postseason tournaments this year. Penn State winning the NIT, North Texas winning the CBI, Northern Colorado winning the CIT. We also had the over the past weekend on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, we had the first 3-on-3 U event, which was a really I found the game pretty entertaining. These quick little games, 21, won by the Big Ten team. Although, Dave, what I thought was interesting was that you had the MEAC and the SWAC, which conferences were rated 31 and 32, both making the semifinals that event too.
Yeah, it's just kind of crazy. It's just a different type of event, a different type of game. And, if this were a 5-on-5 full court event with coaching and timeouts over 40 minutes, do the MEAC and SWAC get that far? Probably not. But in a 3-on-3 environment, they have some guys that played really well and were really effective. I mean, but they were fun to watch. It was a fun event. I didn't watch it. I probably watched less of it than what you did, but what I saw, it was mesmerizing.
It was. I don't know, Sleek, I don't know if you caught much of it. I caught some of it every single day, and there were some exciting finishes, and kind of weird to have a game that just as soon as somebody hits 21, the game is over. But it was, I thought, pretty fun and nice for the Big Ten to get the win, but nice to see the MEAC and the SWAC teams, even the Big West team, make a run there.
I'm sure it would have been nice to follow, but unfortunately I didn't really get a chance to see any of those games. But instead, I was probably paying a little more attention to the three-point contest, which was taking place on Thursday night, where I think there was a kid from William & Mary who won the three-point contest for the men and also beat a lady from Michigan who had won it for the women. But there were also some pretty nice slam dunks coming in the contest where I think two of the most imaginative dunks this year would have been throwing it off the side of the backboard and dunking it, and someone else I think also taking a selfie mid dunk as well.
Yeah, the deep three dunkers were fun.
The small school dunkers are fun to watch. I'm getting to the point myself personally where I think the dunk contests are getting just a little bit boring.
They've all been done.
Yeah, it's been done exactly. But I'll tell you what, I want to get to another topic here. I wanted to kind of go through, now that the season is over, and kind of ask each of you to kind of put some grades on each of the major conferences. And Joby, after you being our ACC guy, just discussed the ACC. It was the conference that put the most teams into the NCAA tournament with 9 teams in there, had a quarter of the Sweet 16. It had 2 teams in the Elite 8. But no Final Four teams in the ACC. Was this a successful season? And you throw in there, I know you don't want to hear it, but 2 awful upsets in the NCAA tournament, Carolina A&M and your Hoos.
Yeah. Well, I think if you're talking about the season as a whole, I think it was an A. They were, you could argue, one of the top conferences, et cetera. A-minus. If you're looking just at the tournament, I mean, the aforementioned North Carolina and Virginia games definitely drag it down to a B, but then you have teams like Clemson and Florida State outliving their seed. So it was a very B+. It was a good conference this year. It was what the ACC should be most years. I really don't have a lot to criticize because there were so many teams in. And you could argue, listening to the committee, first team out was Notre Dame. Next team, a couple of teams out was Louisville.
I mean, which means the committee was drunk.
I think honestly. the committee, I don't necessarily. But the point is, you had a lot of teams in consideration. You know, thank you, Pitt, for giving everybody a win or two. But it's still – if we played everybody, John, it would be two. But it was only one for some teams. But the fact of the matter is, it was a good year. And without a doubt, no complaints. And the ACC, normally in a year like this, is going to have a Final Four team or two. That, nothing to complain about.
Well, Tytel, you agree with that? I mean, because it's almost like every year you're going to put one, at least one ACC team in the Final Four. We didn't have one this year. So do they merit an A, B plus, B?
I don't think you can give them an A if your measure of success is winning a title and or making the Final Four. The fact that Florida State and Syracuse went so far beyond what anybody expected, and like Joby said, like it's not just the cream of the crop where Big East has like Villanova and Xavier as a pair of number one seeds. But when you have the whole middle of the conference, everybody won 20 games, it seemed like, except Pitt. And BC, 19-16, right on the doorstep when I thought that they were going to be horrible for the next decade to come. I mean, regular season, I think, solid B. And postseason, I would say, I don't think I can give them an A. I'd give them maybe B+ because of the unexpected value of the lesser teams, even though Virginia totally ruined any chances for an A.
Well, but you got to look at with Carolina, the way they lost to A&M, I think has got to be another big negative there too. But still,
I'm giving them an F for the 20 game season. F.
They're not there yet, David.
Actually, well, it's a preemptive F.
That 20 game season's awful. Yeah. And I agree for the same reasons David will say.
Yeah,
I agree.
So Stalica, you're our Big East guy. Obviously, Villanova cut down the nets. You had 16 teams. Six teams in the field. How do you rank this season for the Big East as a whole?
I would say overall, I would probably give it a B. Villanova certainly helps winning the national title, and Xavier certainly had a nice season themselves, winning the Big East outright for the first time. At least in the new Big East, it was the first time someone other than Villanova has been able to accomplish that. But it does get a little bit sour with an early exit in both the Big East tournament and the NCAA tournament. But by the same token, below Villanova and Xavier, there were a lot of teams hovering around the 8-9 seed range. I mean, for Providence, it probably was a plus given that Emmett Holt never played a game this year because of injury, and Butler did a decent job reloading after, I'm trying to think, some of the guys like Kravitz and Weidman's is leaving this year, along with that Keelan Martin. So it seems like they're going to be following the same script in second year for LaValle Jordan. But Seton Hall is going to be another team that is going to see a bunch of seniors move on. But at least they did finally get one NCAA tournament victory and came close to getting a second against Kansas. But I think the other odd thing we have to look at in the Big East, how is DePaul under NCAA investigation? Didn't we already have this discussion when we were talking about South Florida a couple years ago? Is athletic fraud now an NCAA violation?
Well, in the end, David, he just gave the Big East a B. I saw a conference that had two one seeds and the national champion. You agree with that? Just a B for the Big East?
I was going to say B too. I mean, yeah, the top of the conference was pretty good, but you start to peel it back a little bit. Well, yeah, Xavier didn't beat anybody that went beyond the round of 32. They didn't beat anybody other than Cincinnati that finished in the rankings. And I'm not saying they didn't deserve the number one, because when you get down to it, well, who else were you going to really give it to? But it was sort of an atypical one seed when you consider no wins away from home against protected seeds and barely any wins of any kind against teams that are in the top half of the bracket. It was a good year, but one of the things about the Big East is that outside of Villanova, why can't they get teams out of that first weekend? It just seems like they're not bad in the tournament, but when compared to teams that send two and three teams to the Elite Eight, like what we've seen, the Big East isn't quite there yet.
Well, Tytel, how about the Big Ten? An interesting season here in that they only put four teams in. They had a team that won 13 games.
Well, one team should have been in. It was a dark web conspiracy.
I'm just tossing them, David, here. 13 teams in conference play, and they couldn't even get an at-large bid. But they also put a team in the national championship game. They threw it an NIT title, even a three-on-three title there. How do you grade the Big Ten this year?
Very difficultly, because it's such a weird thing that if you only have four teams in the tournament compared to the ACC, which had more than twice as many, it's hard to say that you're better. But like you said, when you get a team in the title game, ACC did not. When you win a lesser tourney like the NIT and the 3x3, and the ACC did not. I'll go B minus just because they didn't have more talented teams. But the fact that the ones who got there, or at least the one in Michigan who went so far, gets a lot of credit. So, yeah, I'll go B minus.
B minus for the Big Ten. And Joby, what about the Big 12 this year? Seven teams in, could have had nine, which we already mentioned, and did finally have a little bit of success in the NCAA tournament.
That's the key. The Big 12, when you take into account the tournament over the last few years, has been C or D even.
Yeah.
The fact is, this year, they didn't fully back up what they did in the regular season, but they certainly didn't overly disappoint like they've had in the past. And as John Tytel has pointed out, it's all of them played Villanova. So, who knows if Texas Tech's in – the South region, if they're sitting in the Final Four.
West Virginia.
And so you've got to think about that, that sort of, element to it. So I think the Big 12, I would like to see more success in the tournament, a solid B, maybe even a B+, given the fact that you had nine teams, and even the 10th team was a good one in Iowa State. Nine teams with legitimate arguments for an NCAA bid, and seven getting it.
David, the SEC, not much success in the tournament, though it did put eight teams in, which is way more than we've seen out of them in recent years.
Yeah, they really did raise the level and the profile of that conference. It wasn't just a couple of really good front runners and a bunch of also-rans. And you watch the conference all year, it was pretty exciting. Alabama coming on really strong at the end. Auburn kind of fading out due to injuries and some other stuff. But all in all, I thought that you have to really like respect just how much better the SEC was this past year than what it's been really since I can ever remember it. Probably since it went out to 14 teams. What grade do you give them? I don't know. It's hard for me to think of it as giving grades as it is to ranking them. I don't think they were as good as the ACC, Big 12, or Big East, but if we're giving those conferences A's and B's, I guess that they deserve at least a little bit less than that, a B maybe, B minus, because they weren't as good as that, but they were much A on the improvement. Holy crap.
Yeah.
A on the improvement, but at the end of the day, they put one team in the Sweet 16 and nobody beyond that. So I think you're looking at a B minus type. I kind of agree with that. And Tytel.
I can't wait for this one. I've been waiting for this one.
Let's do the Ivy League. Yeah.
Three teams in the field, two of which were barely in because they were in the first four, 0-3. I guess you could talk about Utah making a run to the NIT finals, but, can we get the Pac-12 over an F?
I mean, can we give them a Q? It's horrible. When you have more assistant coaches fired due to scandal than you have wins in the NCAA tournament, I think you have to give them below an F. It was just atrocious. All the Pac-12 tourney losses were embarrassing because they seemed to be to teams who were not as good as them. Obviously, when you have a play-in game like UCLA and ASU and 11-11, it can go either way. But Arizona loss was pretty much inexcusable. I don't know if all the top players who are underclassmen are going to leave. I really think Arizona is not going to have a winning record next year, which is something I've never said in my life. I would go with a Q.
A Q for the
Pac-12. I think my nieces and nephews would go T for troll.
Yeah.
Well, Sleek, let me stick with you. The American Conference did put three teams in the field, two of which with protected seeds, yet could not get out of the first weekend. How do you grade the American this year?
Honestly, if we're going top to bottom, I am going to go ahead and say B minus here. It's not like two or three years ago where there were like four or five decent teams and then a cliff where everyone below that is going to be like RPI 250 and worse. This year, the only real poisonous teams were, it seemed, East Carolina, South Florida. Tulane is also trying to get out of that chasm, but weren't able to completely pull that off. Houston was much improved, and if not for a buzzer-beating three, could have made a run to the Sweet 16, possibly deeper with guys like Rob Gray on their roster. But Cincinnati, on the other hand, it just seems to be another one of those years where they actually had a decent run, but you just knew something was going to happen with round two themselves, because Mick Cronin has only made it past that checkpoint once in his career, no matter how many times he gets snippy with opposing media. But when teams like UConn are down, that's also going to hurt the perception of the American as well.
Yeah, I think you're right out there. B minus, maybe C plus on the American. A couple other conferences, real quick here. Joby, Mountain West, a bit of a bounce back year, finally putting multiple teams in and getting to the Sweet 16.
If we're looking just at the tournament, you know, this is obviously a bounce back year. The only reason they had two teams in is because, Nevada lost, in the tournament. So Nevada was real. They proved it. They proved they were real. And give them credit, in that regard. So I think the Mountain West is what they are. This was a good year for them. But let's be honest, if like you said, it depends. Are you grading on expectations? Expectations, solid B. But if you're not grading on expectations, saying, hey, are they as good as, I'll say, the American. I would rate the American higher, for instance.
It is higher.
Houston was a big, big surprise and has lifted all boats to a degree. And once UConn and Memphis, if Memphis ever recovers, but UConn and Memphis are real teams, I don't see the Mountain West getting – their ceiling is a lot lower than where, for instance, the American ceiling is. And I think they're going to be stuck in C-land for a long time. They should be happy about that.
And they also missed a chance to raise their ceiling because Gonzaga has also –
yes.
But now they're going to be staying in the WCC, which we'll get into a little bit later on.
Good mention, John. That is an excellent point. Because that is a surprising
decision. Not saying it's the wrong one, we'll get into that a little bit later.
Well, basically, my understanding is that Gonzaga came up with basically a list of demands for the West Coast Conference, which include a shorter conference season so they could schedule more games against more, better opponents, and the West Coast Conference gave them everything they wanted, so they stayed. Let's stick there. Dave, what about the West Coast Conference? Only one team in the field this year. The Zags, though, they made the Sweet 16 run, could have gone further if not for the Tilly injury. So, was this a good season or a bad year for the West?
You have to give the West Coast Conference an A for retaining Gonzaga when I thought for sure they were out the door. I mean, the Mountain West, while down, it is a higher basketball brand, I would think. I mean, and the competition is typically better. I mean, I know it's been really bad in recent years, and this year is still not where it was 4 or 5 years ago, but it's bigger programs, it's bigger budgets, the basketball is a little better, and I think Gonzaga would have brought a lot to it. And they had been frustrated with the West Coast, at least that was my perception of it. And I thought they were gone. I was kind of surprised. I think it was Stalika's email, or maybe it was yours, where I was just kind of surprised to learn that they weren't leaving. I thought that they were gone.
I hope one of their demands was that St. Mary's actually beef up their non-conference schedule in future years.
Yeah.
Well, there's requirements for a certain amount of home games and a certain amount of games against better conferences. So there's some scheduling increases there, right, with some of the rules the West Coast came out with. But a couple other conferences real quick here. Titel, the Atlantic 10 got two teams in, one of them barely. Each team did pick up a single win in the tournament at least, but overall, bad year for the A-10.
Oof. I'm a little biased because they were kind enough to invite me to their conference tourney in D.C. I think this was looking like a one-bid league as of
a couple months ago, Chad.
Because somebody on this panel had given up on St. Bonnie's. And then they turned into a three-bid league like that with all of them winning 20-plus games. And right, they all played respectably. I'll go C-plus just to be different. But I was impressed that they had three teams in the tourney.
You were Dayton.
Well, I mean, nothing against Rhodey because they were really good. But as a whole, this league was just bad. And you're not used to seeing the A-10 with double-digit sub-RPI caliber teams, and that's what it was this year.
I truly believe the A-10, with the falling off of UMass, you know, which obviously I think they're down for the count. I don't see a comeback for UMass anytime soon. And you're seeing, I think this year with the three teams was more of a dead cat bounce for what is a conference as far as being a mid-year conference trying to compete with the Americans of the world. I don't see them getting to that level.
But there was a down year, so the VCU's, the Dayton's, that really I think hurt.
When you look at the programs in this conference, Dayton, VCU, St. Louis, St. Joe's to a large extent, Davidson, the Bonnies, who were good this year and have been good for the last couple of years, Rhodey, of course, UMass, who has a history. This league should be better than what it is. And for years and years, Chad and I think some of you would trumpet about how underexposed the league was because it was actually really good. And you just wonder what the hell happened to it. And I'm kind of perplexed by the A-10 in general. Why isn't this league better? Because it's good programs with good fan bases and big markets. Why isn't it better?
Every one of those programs is declining. Yeah. It's declining since post-Shaka. It is. Dayton's declining. I don't know. And the problem is it feeds on itself. It's got an awful media deal that
it feeds
on itself. Kids can't be on TV, and it's a cycle. They're in a bad cycle where some conferences can break out of that. And, you know, the Big East being the obvious one, you know, they go off and they have a nice, they really did a smart thing on their media deal to be the preeminent, conference in on their network. And it's showing kids can find them, et cetera. And I think the chasm, to use John Stalica's word, will just get further between the American. I do think the American's going to continue to improve, assuming UConn rebounds, and the Big East versus the A-10. I think the A-10, unfortunately, is going to be relegated further and further behind. That'll hurt St. Louis. That'll hurt Dayton. That'll hurt VCU. Rhodey, once EC Matthews is gone, Rhodey's going to fall right back into that trap, unfortunately.
I want to hit one other conference. We're not going to go through all the under-the-radar conferences, but one other I think is worth a mention here for a grade is Conference USA. Only Marshall made the tournament, but they picked up a win. But you're looking at a conference that had a team with Middle Tennessee that was in the national rankings late in the season. Western Kentucky had some huge wins during the regular season, made a run to the NIT semifinals postseason. You had 25 wins out of Old Dominion. You had improved seasons from the likes of Texas San Antonio, UAB. North Texas won the CBI. David, in terms of under-the-radar conferences, I think that Conference USA could be right there in the A range for what they did this year, aren't they?
Oh, high A. And the other thing they did, and I cannot believe you did not mention the curtain. They had the curtain. They get an A, period.
They get, yeah, I thought it was a great year for Conference USA. And I guess we should mention the Missouri Valley Conference as well, Tytel. Do you give a conference an A just based on what one team did in the postseason?
You can give an A-. I mean, Sister Jean and the crew was just beyond anybody's wildest dreams, setting records and hearkening back to the 60s when they actually won a title, which seems impossible today, but it happened. I'll go A-. It was just an amazing ride.
All right. I guess on that note, let's go through here. What else do we want to hit on tonight here, guys? I think, David, you had another topic you wanted to hit on or no?
Yeah, I'll throw this one out there. The Loyola run, and this is I'm kind of curious to get a lot of people's opinions on this. The committee every year, well, they're going to take a bath no matter what they do. In the years that you have a lot of under-the-radar teams in there and inside the bubble, they say that, well, these teams wouldn't do it if they played in a good conference. And then in the past 3 years, it's been pointed out how those bids have been fewer and fewer. Well, the selection committee doesn't schedule games. They would probably like to, but all they can really do is evaluate what's there. And one of the things, so my gripe isn't with the committee. I'm not going to accuse them of needing to do anything any differently from what they do. But what I would like to see is a lot of the good teams from under the radar conferences, and there's more than what people realize. I don't think most of the good teams are in the top 7 and 8 conferences. I'm not going to argue that that's any different, but I do think there's more good under the radar teams than what people realized. I mean, even if you look at what UNC Greensboro did in their game against Gonzaga and how Marshall, who finished fourth, got to the round of 32, there were three teams that all year long were probably better than they were. You looked at what Loyola did, and they almost lost their quarterfinal game to Northern Iowa. None of this would have ever happened. What can be done to facilitate more opportunities for good teams that don't play 18, 16 game schedules where more than half of those are opportunities at quality wins? I don't really know. Can the committee just mandate and just come out and say, hey, we'd like to see you play these teams?
Well, I don't know. I mean, Tytel, what do you think? You're shaking your head.
I don't think the committee mandates anything. They say we have criteria and people do what they want to do. And if you're a team like St. Mary's, I think it bites you in the butt. And if you're a team like Syracuse, who is on the bubble and gets in, I think you're like, oh, I'm glad I'm in a good conference. But they play a bunch of games at the Carrier Dome against crappy teams in November. I mean, I don't think there was any regrets by the Orange.
But there are some conferences that do at least try to put together some of these showcases, like the Missouri Valley and the Mountain West. They do their own challenge that, while not on the level of the ACC or Big Ten, it does give at least the teams at the top a chance at a decent opponent.
Yeah, and that's a great point, John. I mean, the bracket buster, forget the television component to the old bracket buster. It was great from an NCAA tournament. And the thing is, when they start getting flex scheduling on it, that's when you get really smart. Because, yeah, the team we think that's great under the radar all of a sudden turns out to be a bust. And, you know, like, hey, at the end of the year, Middle Tennessee was clearly better than Western Kentucky. Wouldn't St. Mary's have rather played Middle Tennessee than Western Kentucky, of course? You know, that sort of
thing. Yeah.
And they need to do that in one step. And the other thing is to follow, I say this every year, follow the Gonzaga model. Follow it. Do you really think, I mean, the Zags get, you know, invited to these neutral court, they're a showcase on a lot of these neutral site tournaments, et cetera. They're seated in them well. They get good competition. It didn't happen overnight. They went on – Mark Few went on the road. Hey, St. Mary's, look at Gonzaga. They went on the road. Yes, it's not fair that you have to go on the road first. It's not fair. Life isn't. But if you want to see a path to how you can get those wins, to get those experiences, to get the credibility to then go to the neutral site, to get people to come to the kennel. You know, right. To do that, you have to make an effort. And teams like Utah State from yesteryear lore and St. Mary's today need to wake up and smell the auto bid, the at-large bids passing them by.
I agree with that, Joby, but it seems to me that we're entering an era of college basketball where the out-of-conference scheduling, at least when you're looking at the top seven, top eight leagues, is almost becoming like bowl games for football. Your typical model, if you look at Kentucky, Duke, Kansas to a large degree, and I mean, those are the ones I'm naming, but any power conference team, it's home bye games, neutral court showcase games, or games that are put together either by a third-party scheduler like ACC Big Ten Challenge and or have a big corporate sponsor. Kansas, they went to Nebraska this year, but that was backed by a corporate sponsor. Kentucky stopped playing Indiana. They wanted to move it to a neutral site and have it you know, as kind of a showcase game with a corporate sponsor, Indiana wanted to keep it on campus. I'm not saying that's right or wrong or good or bad for the sake, but what I am saying is that if you are not playing basketball at that level, like Vermont isn't, like Loyola wasn't, like a lot of these good teams, East Tennessee State, UNC Greensboro, Wright State, who's probably going to be very good next year, College of Charleston, who we knew was going to be good this year, there are teams that you can identify as likely to be very good, and they're not going to get those opportunities to play in those types of games.
Vermont is a great example. They win that game in Rupp that they came kind of close to doing. Who knows? At that point, their profile looks 100% different. And they just might get in at large.
I think they do. It can be done.
Vermont did the right thing.
Yeah.
By doing that, they put themselves in a position to try to succeed. Vermont's a great example of what to do. And you know what? They came within a few points, maybe. We don't know because they didn't win it, and thus they were never in the true discussion of an at large. They came within a few points of being seriously under consideration for an at large. And they would have, as you pointed out earlier in the show, been off camera, would have been extremely dangerous.
Yeah, and they are good. It's just it seems like now to get those games, you have to be on the receiving end of a bye game, and you got to do it all in the first 6 weeks of the season, and hold on tight the rest of the way, because if you trip up a time or two, you're done. Now, there are things that bother me about how you under the radar team schedule, but. I do think that they are at a circumstantial disadvantage.
Yeah.
Yes. True.
Yeah. Well, let's one more real quickly. It's just Delico. There's been a lot of coaching news. There's going to be a lot more. There's still a lot of major, not major, but some significant jobs, I guess I'd call them, like LaSalle, the Rhode Island jobs, still open. So as we go through the offseason, we're probably going to have a podcast devoted a lot to looking at the coaches' changes. But your school there, Xavier, does have a new head coach. I don't know if you wanted to discuss Travis Steele a little bit.
Yeah, it's going to become official tomorrow when Steele is announced as the 18th head coach in Xavier's program history. He's gotten the blessing of the current players as well as former players. So, number one, that does keep some stability in the program. And number two, we should probably find out in the next couple days as far as what assistants you'll hire. But my understanding is I think Mario Mercurio, who is their director of basketball operations, and Matt Jennings, their strength and conditioning coach, are going to be retained on the staff, which is actually going to be a pretty big plus considering Matt took two assistants with him to Louisville now. But I think Rhode Island is another program that still has to fill their opening after Dan Hurley went across state lines to take the Connecticut position.
Yeah. The Rhode Island and LaSalle jobs are probably the two biggest jobs out there left open. But I guess on that note, I guess why don't we run through any other thoughts, whether it be a final thought or any other discussions anybody else wants to bring up here. I'll run through each of you for any other thoughts in that way. And Joby, let me start with you.
Yeah, why don't we go back, because we were going to talk about, and I will bring it up as my final thought, is the interesting travails of Gonzaga. And, I how it was a done deal to go to the Mountain West. And I would love to know all the various particulars of what happened to keep them in. Yes, less scheduling, all this stuff. But the one thing that points out, that we point out, is more opportunities for them to go on the road and play those big games that you, David and I were talking about that made Gonzaga what they are. But this happens, right, in conflicting with what I was just saying recently, this happens at the same time that conferences are going to 20-game schedules. Will those teams that are willing to play Gonzaga, because it's a showcase game now, you know, will those games, will they find themselves not able to fit in to those to fill those gaps that now the mountain that now the West Coast will allow them to have? It'll be an interesting dynamic of how the impact of the 20 game schedule is. If you want to see if there really is an impact, pay attention to the Zags the next year. See what their schedules look like over the next few years. Because if they're having trouble finding opponents, then wow, it's a road that I don't know if college basketball really does want to go down, because that's when they're the canary in the coal mine on the difference, the true difference between the have and have not.
Well, Joby, I guess I'd have two thoughts on that. Number one, obviously, Gonzaga could still bolt after this year. It's just, you know, I mean,
true. Go.
And the other thing is, do we end up with a net effect of suddenly they find a way to add another game or two and start a week earlier into the season to give teams more chances for non-conference games, and all we end up doing is making a 33-game regular season instead of a 31. So, yeah. I mean, that could be another net effect of this as well. But Tytel, how about you?
For me, it's just another amazing season. I mean, had you told me a year ago that Arizona would have its most expensive player ever in DeAndre Ayton, who also happened to be, in my opinion, one of, if not the best players to ever wear an Arizona uniform, you had told me that the FBI was going to get involved and change perhaps the face of the sport. You had told me about Sister Jean. You had told me about Penn making the tournament, PK80 being the best. I mean, it's just, for all the ups and downs, like, it's just every year I see 10 things. It's not just that there's one amazing, there's 10 amazing things that I never thought I'd see, which is why I love this sport so much and which is why I keep coming back every year for better and for worse.
I think that's excellent. I'd have to echo every word you said there. I mean, really is one of the reasons we love this game, for better or for worse. Sleeka, how about you?
Yeah, unfortunately, during the CBI, we also found out that while Jacksonville State was, I think, in the quarterfinal round winning at Central Arkansas, it turned out an EF3 tornado had actually damaged the roof on their newly renovated arena, and it also damaged the playing floor. And with this also being a spring break at Jacksonville State, a major catastrophe was definitely averted right here. So hopefully best wishes go out to the Jacksonville community as they continue to rebuild from that disaster. And hopefully they'll be ready to go for next season when Ray Harper and his crew should have another competitive team in the OVC.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. But David, before I go to you for final thoughts, I want to throw my final thought in here. We are likely to see some rule changes in this offseason.
No!
I know we hate the idea, but there is a chance that quarters are going to cut.
No!
And I just want to make a point here. I made this on Twitter also, but I'll throw this out here. When you look at football, the college game and the pro game both use 15-minute quarters. When you look at hockey, the college game and the pro game are the same. They all both use 3 20-minute periods. You look at baseball, both games are the same. They both use 9 innings. So why do we have a difference between the pro game and the college game in terms of the time of the game in basketball? So, David, I know you don't like it, or maybe you do, but there's all this talk about changing the time of the game. I absolutely think it should happen, and I absolutely believe that the NBA has to go to 2 20-minute halves.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would support that. That is a great, great final thought.
Your thought, David. 2 20-minute halves.
Yeah, it was a fun year. It always is. It's fun doing this with you guys. It's kind of funny. The season starts in the first couple weeks of November, but we're kind of actually together about 3 or 4 weeks before that. So it seems like every night for 6 months, we're all together, either doing the podcast or on the emails, and it's just a lot of fun. And even, you know, you guys and some that aren't here, Rocco, Brian, Kyle Lamb, who we love to have fun with, and just everybody. And like Tytel already hit some of the high points of the season. We're not going away, but it is kind of going into off-season mode. But I guess that's just my final thought. It was a fun year, but you guys make it even more fun for me. So thanks. Going sentimental on you all.
Yeah, that was heavy, David. But those notes, though.
But we are not doing quarters, and Nebraska will be back next year, and Kansas and Missouri will play again, and the charity games will be back, and Kansas – well, I still think that Nebraska should have won it all this year had it not been for the dark web. They beat Michigan by more than Villanova did.
Well, I guess I got to end this season.
Mm-hmm.
can't get it to stop. There we go. On behalf of David Griggs, Joby Fortson, John Slica, John Titel, we'll also throw in shout outs to everybody else who joined us during the course of this season, including, see here, we had Rocco Miller was with us. We had Matt Sikowski, Brian Black, Lee Delvecchio. I think even Kyle Lamb joined us once or twice. And anybody else out there, thanks for joining us this year. It was a great season. We will be back sometime next month with the first of many, or a series at least, of off-season podcasts. We'll be back in October with preseason previews. We're 217 days away. Have a great off-season, everybody, and we'll talk to you again real soon.